Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 297. Have you ever been confused by the naming of modules you're importing from a package? Is there a standard way to organize and name your Python virtual environments? This week on the show, Brett Cannon returns to discuss the Python enhancement proposals he's been working on recently. We start with PEP 794, which extends the metadata fields for Python packages to specify the import names a project provides. The metadata will help developers identify the correct project to install when they know the import name, or the import names a project provides once installed. We also dive back into WebAssembly to discuss PEP 816, which specifies the WASI support in CPython releases. And we wade into the controversy around PEP 832, which proposes standards around the naming and the discovery of virtual environments. Brett shares his motivation for being a prolific author and supporter of PEPs. We discuss his promotion of standards and protocols to simplify the Python ecosystem for current and future developers. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Brett, welcome back.
Thanks for having me back, Christopher. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I'm excited to talk to you about, well, three different PEPs that I kind of mentioned on the show across time here. A few of them have been accepted, a few are on the fence here, and then something totally new at the very end here that you mentioned was going to be announced at PyCon. And so now that PyCon's happened, that's been announced. So I'm excited to dig into this stuff.
Yes, I seem to not be able to put my pencil down and stop working, so.
Was there a thing at the end where you were told to put it down? Like the end of a Scantron test or something?
Yeah, exactly, right? It's like, okay, everyone put your pencil down, test over. It's like, no, gotta get the last questions in. Yeah, no, I seem to have a problem of not saying no to my own ideas and not writing some pep about it.
Well, I guess we could mention the stats that you mentioned to me when we got on the call here, that you're the fourth most prolific PEP writer. Is that right?
Yeah. So I'm tied with Victor Sinner. Barry Warsaw, Guido, and Alyssa Coughlin have written more.
Okay.
But I am now tied for fourth. And apparently I am an author or co-author. Which, by the way, doesn't mean I was the co-author necessarily from the beginning. Some PEPs I've become co-author of over the years just because people stepped away or I've just ended up helping maintain some active PEP long enough to become co-author. But I'm co-author or author on 4.8% of all PEPs that have ever been written.
Wow.
Yeah. Some might say I have a problem.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think this group of them are all not only interesting, but also I think would be good for people learning Python. The goal I feel of most of your PEPs in recent history, to me, are to move things toward standards, to try to unscramble this sort of packaging world that has developed over the years of Python. And things like that, where this like very diverse community of Python people and tools and so forth were reluctant to settle on standards. And again, we could, you know, talk about that a little bit, but do you feel that way, that that's kind of some of the goals that you have?
Oh, it's actually very explicitly the goal. I was the dev manager for the Python extension in VS Code for 7 years.
Yeah.
So I had very frontline experience of what it's like to be a developer for using Python, right? From total beginners, first day, to people like me who have been doing it for decades, literally. And just what the steps were that tripped them up. And We are very lucky to have a lot of passionate users and people who want to develop tools for Python. But it does mean that there typically are a lot of tools that kind of do similar things, but in different ways to fit people's needs.
Yeah.
Which is good or bad, depending on your view of the world. But Python also predates a lot of these language ecosystems like Rust and NPM / Node and these other Go, where all the tooling was baked in, right?
Okay.
So because of that, we've ended up in a culture for Python of the Python core team and packaging, whoever else, doesn't really dictate what tools you use.
Yes.
And so part of that meant that there was a bazillion different ways to do things, and it was never easy to kind of, I don't want to say control necessarily, but way to know exactly how to do things.
Yeah.
And so I went in, when I started to work on packaging stuff, with a goal of making everything a choice, not a requirement. Right? Like when I first got started, the first goal was to make setup tools a choice, not a requirement.
Okay.
Because up to that point, everyone kind of just implicitly assumed everyone used setup tools, right? Versus, well, maybe setup tools doesn't quite work the way I want or doesn't quite do the thing I need it to do, right? And so that's how PyProject.toml and the project table in it came about, right? And the build system table, right? Is like, how do we kind of make it so that you can choose the build backend you want. And then how do we make it so you don't have to write the same bit of metadata five different ways because five different tools all want it written down differently.
Right.
Right. So it's just been a constant, like, just where's there a universal agreement that this is something most developers need or do? And let's write it down so that it's the artifacts that we all agree to, right? It's not necessarily the process. You can use whatever tool you want. Let's just all get the tools agree, though, that there is a common denominator here of, like, every project needs a name. How do we write the name down?
Sure.
Right? And that's what a lot of this work has been. So it's happened to have been around packaging to start, but I'm kind of expanding it to more developer workflow.
Yeah.
Goal.
I think that's a lot of this stuff. Yeah.
And we'll talk about the first PEP that's more not packaging, but kind of hits on that later.
Yeah.
But I became a dad 2 years ago. And I don't want my kid coming home from school saying, hey, dad, why is it so hard to get going in Python? Because chances are, if they're going to learn a programming language in school, it's going to be Python. And I want them to have the nicest experience that they can have. So I now have a decade to make that happen and not have my kid come home disappointed in how dad has handled things. So yeah, no, you're totally right.
Have you ever heard that from anyone else that they're thinking about the future of their children using the language and stuff like that? Is that a shared feeling among other parents that you've met that are in the Python ecosystem?
It's a good question. I don't know if I've ever heard it specifically articulated, but there are enough of us who realize that it is important for educational reasons to make it work nicely. That is a general goal. To make sure that Python works for everyone.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's just kind of the ethos we all have, right, in the community of being open and welcoming and inclusive. And that means being inclusive from beginners to experts. And it's very easy for all of us being experts to make sure the experts are taken care of, but you have to very explicitly make sure you also worry about the beginners. And that's always been a thing, like the steering council's always cared about and other core devs as well, because we've all been to conferences like PyCon and EuroPython or whatever, and met those beginners who have gone like, oh my goodness, this has made such a big deal in my life. Thank you so much for making this easy to work with.
Yeah.
Had teachers come to us and say, this is great. Oh, by the way, there's this other pain point, right? et cetera, right?
So, do you take requests?
well, exactly, right? So it's always in our mind, whether it's top of mind or just in the back of our head, it's always, how do we make sure it works well for beginners? And I just happen to now have a beginner baked into the house.
So. Yeah.
Someday, maybe. Not forced.
I think about often about with the podcast and our audience, just always thinking about that. And that's why I like having you on to kind of discuss some of this stuff. And I guess we could just dig right in.
Sure.
I'll try not to go too far because we want to cover each one of these. And maybe this, I don't know if this is the simplest one. I don't know. So PEP 794, titled Import Name Metadata.
Mm-hmm.
Has been accepted, right?
Correct.
So this is, again, still on the packaging side. So I always think of like Accepted as being like, oh, this will be in the next release of Python. And it's not really that type of pep.
Correct.
Okay. So it's more of a packaging pep.
It's entirely a packaging pep.
Okay. So the concept is, and I'll read the abstract because I think that might be a quick way for us to get through it. Mm-hmm. The PEP proposes extending the core metadata specification for Python packaging to include two new repeatable fields named import-name and import-namespace to record the import names that a project provides once installed. New keys named import-names and import-namespaces will be added to the project table in the pyproject.toml for providing the values for the new core metadata fields. This leads to the introduction of core metadata version 2.5. So again, kind of leaning on this pyproject.toml file, which I think is, you know, we've covered multiple times, the I was talking about lock files and other things like that. And I'm seeing it more and more all the time, which I think is really, really great.
I didn't screw that one up. Thank goodness.
Well, I'll share a couple other articles that dig into it a little bit. One was Goran et al. He has an article towards fixing Python project names and import modules, which I think is pretty good. Actually, it's just this one on it. And he gives a couple of examples that I personally have experience and kind of like scratch my head on. And it's the pillow example, I think, is probably the most common one. Yep. You might go and say, all right, I'm going to pip install pillow. And then you're like, all right, now I'm going to use it in my Python script or what have you. And you're like, import pillow. And it's like, no, it's actually import PIL. And you're like, why is it public image limited? What is this? Oh, sorry.
yeah.
I always think that's kind of a weird thing that happens. The other example is Beautiful Soup that a lot of people use. Where you install Beautiful Soup or Beautiful Soup 4 or what have you. And then it's like, okay, well, how do I import that? And it's import BS4.
Yep. Scikit-learn's another good one because you import sklearn instead.
Yeah, yeah. And so I don't know the history of like why people have selected that. So those are the kind of like a little bit of namespace confusion for the user to like, well, how do I use this thing?
Right.
And then I think about like tooling and everything kind of moving toward AI. And I had this thought where if something is trying to figure out how to help you with this type of thing, and it sees the idea of import PIL, and it's trying to add that package, and then it can't figure out like, well, I can't find that, you know, on PyPI or what have you, or other things like that. And so other examples that are kind of covered in some of this is the dreaded utils module that a lot of people like to use that could potentially cause this sort of namespace collisions and pollution across different things. And so I don't know if you want to just talk about like kind of some of the reasoning behind it. I mean, obviously the abstract covered some of that, but
you've done a great sales pitch. So
okay, good.
We'll see how much I have to do. I do want to say one thing though. Just a few seconds ago, I did say, I'm glad I didn't screw up on any of these PEPs. I want to be clear. I had co-authors on all these other PEPs. So I want to say, anything that went wrong is my fault. Anything that went well is all of us. Just to be clear, I don't want to mislead anyone or make anyone think I'm taking personal credit for all of PyProject.toml and the project table.
Yeah, yeah.
Without the way. Yeah. So, for instance, I can actually tell you the history behind Pillow, right? So, PIL, which is the Python image library, was started by Frederick Lund, and Pillow became basically a fork because Frederick just stopped working on it.
Okay.
Why at scikit-learn with sklearn? My guess is just that I've noticed the data science side of the community really likes shortened module names.
Like PD for pandas and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. So I think they just baked that in that way. Plus, there's a dash in scikit-learn, and you can't have dashes. So instead of just going underscore, I think they just shortened it. Beautiful Soup 4 is very long to type. So my guess is they just went why make everyone go through that?
Yeah.
There are various reasons. But yeah, I mean, it's a gotcha, right? It's surprising, but it's totally legitimate. And as you said, sometimes people also write modules that whose names are going to get trampled on each other because they happen to use the same module name. So even if it's a different file, right? Like if the import's going to cause the import to resolve the same thing, who's going to win that race? So yeah, it's a side effect of just how Python did things originally, because don't forget, we started Python well before packaging was even a thing. And then originally, the name of your project had nothing to do with necessarily the code, because it was just zip files that you unzipped into your project code and literally everyone just vendored everything. There was no concept of wheels, for instance. So historically, there just was no force. And then by the time we decided to start having standards around packaging, it's like, well, do we force everyone to rename all their projects or rename all their imports and break all that code? Well, no. So we just have had to learn to live with it. So I wrote PEP794 as a way to kind of just write down the fact that there are packages out there that, while they might be named scikit-learn, you don't import them that way. You import them with sklearn.
Yeah.
Or with Pello, you import PIL. And the reason I did it was it goes both directions, right? One is, hey, if I install this project, what am I going to get to? What will I import, right?
Okay.
And some things might be a little surprising, right? So for instance, if you install PyTest, it's PyTest, it's underscore PyTest, and it's PY. And you might not realize that, right? So knowing that kind of upfront is kind of good to know, because like, where the hell did this thing come from, right? So like if PyPI or some other tooling could just say like, hey, when you install PyTest, it's not just PyTest, it's three things, right? Or when you install Pello, it's PIL.
Right.
That's one thing. The other thing is from a tooling perspective, right? I'm just going to use VS Code as an example because obviously I've worked on that.
Right.
But this applies to pretty much any editor or any tool that has to kind of introspect on things. Let's say you type import PIL and you get that squiggle saying like, hey, this isn't installed. What's going on?
Right.
And you want to install it. You ain't going to find PIL on PyPI, or at least not the one you want. You want Pello. So
How
the heck are tools that are trying to help map import names back to the project to know what to install or put in your lock file or put in your PyProject.toml as a dependency?
Yeah.
How are they supposed to figure that out? And today, you can't. You either have to walk every package on PyPI, look into the files that are in the wheels and stuff, and reverse map them. By the way, assuming that you can do that reliably, because once again, having written most of Python's import system, I can tell you there are a lot of fun little tricks you can play to make names not match directly to file names. Mm. So you can't even rely on like, oh, well, if I look in the wheel file, I can see these files are here. It's like, yeah, but they might not show up that way when you import.
Okay.
But at least if you have this metadata, you can just look at the metadata, right? You don't have to look at the individual files. And you can download metadata now directly from PyPI and just look at that, right? So the performance is not like you're downloading like 1 gig of PyTorch
just
to look at its metadata file. You can just grab the little like kilobyte of metadata and look at that. And so that's why I did it, right? Was just kind of, how do we expose this data out so that tools can actually use it? Whether it's PyPI showing it to you somehow in its UI, just like, hey, if you install this, this is what you'll get. Right. Or tools going like, hey, how the heck do I find something to install to make this thing exist?
Yeah, okay.
And
so it's kind of coming and going, if you will. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. It's both directions. Top of it, as you said, right, like if someone's got kind of like a generic util and didn't realize they'd done that, and the installant said they might trample that name because they just happened not to think about the fact that this other project happens to have that thing.
And then there's the malicious version of that too, where somebody's trying to squat on that space potentially. So
Although let's be honest, chances are people are going to lie in that case, right? Because there's nothing forcing projects to use this or to even follow what they say. So it's not, I wouldn't go too far into the whole security thing, but at least it helps you not mess up, right? It's definitely projects doing the right thing. You won't accidentally overwrite that under util, or if you just say, I'm going to have a generic module named Py.
Yeah.
And I'm also going to install PyTest. Like, sorry, that's going to conflict. Someone's going to win, someone's going to lose, and that's not going to work out well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How often do you, when you import things, we talked a little bit about the, import pandas as, PD or whatever. Mm-hmm. Is that a common thing that you do yourself? No. Okay.
No, I only see that on the data science side of the world, of doing the as thing and shortening.
Yeah.
I never do. So I will say my personal practice for imports is I import to the module and I import to the objects in the module. So I don't go from Django.models import data model. I do from, by the way, that might be the wrong import name, just to be clear. Don't shoot me angry messages. I got it wrong. But I do from Django import models, right? And I'd stop there. And I'd only use as if I had to clarify because it's going to conflict with some name or something.
Right.
But I do that so that it's a little more obvious to me when I'm writing my code that, hey, this is not in this module. It's not something I wrote. It's coming from somewhere else.
Okay.
Right. Because I don't necessarily expect everyone to write their names with a prefix so that I can import that name directly.
Right.
Right. Because like Django does that, but not every other project in the world does that prefixing to make it very clear. So if I import that class, that function directly, that makes sense. Right. My canonical example is random. If you import a random function in some code and you're a couple hundred lines down away from your import statement, what random is it? Is it secrets.random? Is it random.random? Is it numpy.random? Like what is it, your own random? Whose random are you working at? Versus look, it's secrets.random. I know exactly what random function I'm dealing with.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that makes sense.
I personally don't do it, but obviously an entire side of the community does the as constantly.
Yeah, yeah.
And most projects, I don't think, really have this differential of names, which is why the PEP specifically says, like, hey, if your name matches your project name when it's normalized, like, don't worry about capitalization stuff.
Right.
You don't have to do it, right? You don't have to ever do it anyway. It's optional, but it's just a nice thing to give projects, just like, hey, if you do this thing with the name, please write it down so that no one's caught off guard and anyone can work with it appropriately.
That makes sense.
Which, by the way, no one should feel weird that they haven't seen this out in the wild yet. As you mentioned, Christopher, this bumped the core metadata version to 2.5. So when we talk about core metadata here, if you look in a source distribution or SDIS, that tar.gz file, that's the pkg-info file.
Okay.
And if you look in a wheel file, that's the metadata file. If you look in there, you'll see that there's a version number on it. And the deal is for that to be supported, multiple things have to happen. First, you have to have PyPI accept it.
Right.
Right. And because otherwise they'll reject it saying, we don't know what that is. And they actually use a project I'm a contributor to called Packaging. Very obviously named, but also makes talking about it a little confusing.
Yeah.
But the packaging package or project needs to support it first, because that's what PyPI actually uses to verify that the metadata is legit and not corrupted or malformed or whatever.
This is our protocol for this stuff.
Yeah. So the way this all has to happen is first you get a PEP accepted that changes the version number. Once you get that, then you have to do a PR to packaging to get that updated so that it can be read appropriately. That then has to be moved over and used in warehouse, which is the project name for PyPI, to then recognize that version number. And also if there has to be any UI changes to make that work. And then once that happens, then projects like Twine need to support it to be able to upload it. And then all of the build backends need to support it, whether that's, we're talking about like PDM backend, Hatchling, UV build, setup tools, Flit, whatever.
Right.
Choose your build backend. They also then have to be able to generate it and recognize that field. So obviously a lot of steps.
Right.
And as of this recording, Twine now supports it. I think they have to do a release still with it in it, maybe. And the build backends then are, I think, all waiting for the next release of Twine. And then they all have, a bunch of them have PRs ready to go once that can go out and be used. But PyPI does have support for it. It's just none of the backends are pushing it. And this all happened actually fairly recently. I actually just looked it up the other day, kind of in prep for this recording. And I was like, where do they all stand on this? I don't babysit the PEPs once they're in, because all the tool maintainers are all part of the conversation anyway.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh yeah, everyone's got PRs and they were all waiting for PyPI to get it, and then they got it, and then they were waiting for Twine to get it, and no, Twine's got it on main. And so I think they're all waiting for Twine to come out, and then they're all going to merge their PRs and be ready to go. I could even be wrong about the Twine release. Maybe it's out. I don't think it's out quite yet, but it's at least there on main and ready to go. So everything's finally lining up that hopefully shortly, sometime at least this year, everyone will be able to use it where it's appropriate. But once again, I think the vast majority of people won't need it. But for those, when you do, it's going to hopefully be handy.
Yeah. So there's a section of PEPs, and I wondered about this.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we can just cover this kind of quickly. But
mm-hmm.
I started noticing it maybe, I don't know, 4 years ago. How to teach this.
Yes.
Is that something that is new? Like, did it get added? Was it always there?
No, it did get added to the PEP process.
Okay.
As you said, maybe four years ago or something.
Okay. So I did recognize it as a new thing. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. No, we occasionally, someone will come up with an idea, just like, how do we make PEPs easier to both have a conversation about a PEP?
Yeah.
Right? Because Python enhancement proposals are meant to record a conversation. It's meant to record the conversation around a proposal to have something happen, to then take it to someone to make a decision as to whether to say, yes, we want to make that change or not.
Right.
Right. So there's always talk about how do we make these documents easier to digest such that both people who are reading them to understand, to help express their opinions, to support or not, or to ask questions, to get clarifications, then help make the document better, right, can do that, but also the decision makers.
So the people that were in the conversation, those people, but now we're talking maybe the people that are outside that conversation.
Yeah, exactly. And then also the people who have to make the final decision, having all the information in front of them so they don't have to go back and read all the details of the whole conversation, right? So like on the steering council,
right,
when I was on it, you try to keep up with the conversation. Well, ultimately, what you really care about is what's in the PEP, because that's what you're going to talk about in the meeting for the steering council. It's like, okay, here's what the PEP says, because that's ultimately going to be the document that leads to what's going to happen, right? It's the reference initially. By the way, once PEPs are accepted, they're historical documents, so don't worry if you ever read a PEP that doesn't seem to match what the world is like today.
Right?
It's okay. It's a historical document.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. But the point is like how to teach this, right? It, as we talked about earlier, we do care about education. And part of that is like, right, how do we make sure that whatever we accept, we have thought through, like, how hard is this going to be to teach someone? Because that kind of plays into thinking through the ramifications of this, right? Like, if we add something that's going to be really hard to teach somebody,
yeah,
maybe we shouldn't do it.
Right.
Right. Or if it's going to be hard to teach, is it really worth it?
Yeah.
Is this truly worth that complication for every educator?
Will it be embraced? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Right? Like, is that poor professor or teacher having to teach their students this going to hate us or love us for doing this? Right? Yeah. Or can they at least, if like, I know this is hard, but here's what you get out of it, right? Like,
yeah,
could a teacher even justify this? So that's partially why that got added. But like, for, yeah, as another example, we just changed the order of the fields, the sections in the PEP, such that the rationale comes after the specification.
Okay.
Because the way the order used to go is you just go abstract to give you the quick one paragraph blurb,
yeah,
so that you can kind of go, do I care or not?
Yeah.
The motivation as to why the heck am I putting so much time and effort in my life to have this become a thing?
Right.
And then it used to be the rationale as to the design of it, and then the specification of the actual thing, which always led to some weird contortions when writing, because it's like, okay, I haven't actually had you read the specification yet, but I have to give the rationale as to why I did the spec this way. So you kind of have to like half write the spec out in the motivation, in the rationale section,
huh,
and then do it again in the spec.
Okay.
So that order has been reversed now. Now, after you give the rationale as to why you're doing this, you get the very, you give the specific spec, and then after you give the spec, you're like, okay, now that you know what the spec is, here's why I designed it this way. And that just happened like literally, I don't know, 2 months, 3 months ago.
Wow. Like, okay. Really recent change. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Definitely this year. So we're always playing with it. We're still too good. If you listen to the steering council, they talk about wanting to improve the PEP process to make it easier to work with the stuff. And this is some of the stuff that kind of ties into it. Just like, let's just make it easier to write these docs and understand them.
Yeah. Totally. So I want to dig into PEP 816. I think this one will be a little briefer, maybe. But we've talked about WASI and WASM, WebAssembly.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Several of our conversations have been about it. And so this one is just short, WASI support, WASI support.
Mm-hmm.
I'll read the abstract again, kind of make it quick. The PEP outlines the expected support for WASI by CPython. It contains enough details to know what WASI and WASI SDK version is expected to be supported for any release of CPython while official WASI support is specified in PEP 11.
Mm-hmm.
So it is kind of saying if you have a version of Python, you will know what target as far as WASI SDK you're expected to use and is expected to support. Was there an experience people had of like, hey, I'm using Python 3.13 and this stuff just doesn't work? Or like, what was it kind of like a Wild West situation? What was going on that you needed to kind of lock this more down?
It was more getting ahead of things before it became a problem.
Okay.
So when it comes to WASI, there's kind of two key, at least when you're compiling a C-based programming language for WASI,
yeah,
as what's called a guest, because the host is the WASI runtime that runs the thing, and the guest is the thing running in it. So Python is a guest in WASI nomenclature within the host of like WASM time.
Okay.
So the deal is, there's two version numbers to care about. There's the WASI version.
Right.
And that defines basically what functionality is available to that guest. And right now we're using what's called commonly called P1 or preview one, or you can kind of squint and pretend it's 0.1.
Okay.
And then there's the WASI SDK version you tie to. And the reason that was important is the WASI SDK has no forwards or backwards compatibility guarantees at the ABI level. So at the binary level.
Okay.
Right. So
these are the features we support, and there's no like moving up or down from here.
Yeah, exactly. Right. Like we might, if they change how some like POSIX level, low level system call thing works, they're allowed to. And there's no guarantee that if you compiled for WASI SDK version 32, that would actually also work in WASI SDK 33.
Okay.
Right. So the goal is to eventually have wheel support for WASI. So in order to have that, we kind of need to agree as a community as to what we're all going to compile to, because once again, they don't line up and agree. So let's say we got NumPy to compile for WASI. Well, if NumPy just decided, let's just use WASI SDK 32 for Python 3.15. Okay. And then someone else that was like outside the data science community, because the data science community is really good about kind of organizing around this kind of thing, around specific SDKs and compiler versions and stuff.
Okay.
Someone else decided to go like, yeah, you know what, we're going to do 29 for whatever reason. Well, now those don't necessarily work together.
Right.
You can't load them together. You can't stitch them together, right? Because they're totally targeting different things and they might not load up. So good luck.
So part of it is not somewhat is Python itself, the core C Python language, but
yes,
it's for other developers of packaging to say, hey, it'd be great if you supported WebAssembly with Python and your packaging did it too. And in order to not have so many pain points, if you're going to do, you know, move your stuff to 3.15 as far as, you know, Python, you would use this WASI SDK version.
Yes. Also, it makes sure that CPython actually compiles on that version.
Okay.
Like there have been times when new features land in the WASI SDK that add like POSIX support for some function at the C level. And it's not implemented the way we expect it, right? I can't remember what version it was, but there was a WASI SDK version bump where they implemented some POSIX function and it didn't match up with what we expected. And we got test failures.
Okay.
So I actually had to go in and say, assume this is not, this doesn't exist. It was optional from a Python perspective. But I had to go like, and I talked to the WASI SDK developers like, hey, our test suite, which by the way, if anyone ever needs a POSIX compliant test suite, CPython is very good at that. Being this old, we have test everything.
Okay.
And also if you need a C compiler test suite, we're pretty good too. I've personally found bugs in both GCC and LLVM thanks to CPython. So
wow.
I'm not kidding. So I went to them and it's like, hey, our test suite says this is how it should work. It's like, well, if you read the POSIX spec very specifically, it says this is not necessary. It's like, well, this is what we expect. So I'm going to just turn it off for Python. And I did. And then the test suite passed. But like, point is, if you compile Python for that target in that Python version, you get a test failure in the test suite.
Okay.
Well, other Python versions wouldn't have that problem with that, with the SDK version of some other version because they hadn't had that function put in yet, right? So it's not only just coordination across the ecosystem for a future PEP to add wheel support by creating a platform tag for WASI wheels, which I do hope to eventually do, but it's also saying, hey, for C Python, I'm going to we/I, because I'm part of the we here, say we are making sure that CPython can compile with this version of the WASI SDK. We make no guarantees that older versions will work and newer versions will work. But at least this version, you can take it, you can compile it, and it should work. And if it doesn't, file a bug. It's a bug.
Okay.
And then but the really other key thing for CPython itself is that WASI version. Because for instance, WASI 0.3, which isn't out quite yet, is adding sockets. Mm. Right? And it's also adding eventually some threading support. And 0.3.1, basically. I think it's technically not going to be a version bump that way, but 0.3 will also be adding threads at some point.
Okay.
So that's also going to be like, okay, are we going to say sockets are supported officially? Because right now sockets are turned off in for WASI in CPython.
Right.
Officially. But when that comes in, my plan is to turn it on officially. So there is officially socket support. But if I do that, I got to make sure I can actually test it and work it. And I want to be able to say like, yes, officially, if there's a bug with the socket support, we can either figure out if it's us or if it's WASI and who do we file the bug with, but we actually officially support it.
Okay.
Versus right now, it's like, nope, we don't support socket. Socket is not a thing. We only support WASI P1, which is 0.1, which has no socket in it. So it's just like, nope, not going there. And it's just not it. So it's basically a way to document how the decision is made of what versions we're going to snap to, right, and kind of what the expectation is and what it would take to ever change that number after something happens. So the PEP specifically says, come beta 1,
yeah,
whatever WASI support and WASI SDK version is in main, plus on the build bots, that is basically the version we're going to go with. If there's any discrepancy, it's at the discretion of the people who are listed as the maintainers of WASI support. If you need to change the WASI SDK version for some reason after beta 1, that is the call of the maintainers of WASI support. But if you need to change the WASI version, because that's way more work, right? As I said, like once we support 0.3, we're going to have sockets,
yeah,
right? That's not a small leap. That actually requires steering council approval.
Okay.
As we're changing what we're promising we're going to support in CPython on a much greater level than WASI SDK, where it's like, it's almost a bug fix.
All right. Yeah.
So that's basically what the PEP says. And then PEP 11, as you mentioned, that's just the PEP that lists platform support.
The supported platforms. Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. So yeah, it's just basically a PEP that outlines the process. And it's actually a process PEP specifically because we have different kinds of PEPs. Most are just standards track, like 794 was standards track for packaging.
Yeah.
But we do have process PEPs that just say like, here's the process we are following for something. And in this case, this is the process we are following on how to standardize WASI support in CPython itself. And so it's active, not final, because it's not considered done. It's just considered actively in being enforced.
Right. And there's actual levels of support that things move up and down that we've discussed before. And yeah.
I will say somewhat ironically, after writing this PEP, I have not gotten around to writing down the support for beta 1. I thought 3.15.0 beta 1 in PEP 11 yet. It's on my to-do list, but it is going to be P1 and WASI SDK 33, which happened to come out the Friday before beta 1 hit. So luckily I had enough time to get that done in it.
We got time to test it all. And yeah, I got a couple quick questions on that.
Yeah.
You talked about how when I think of POSIX, I think of access to mostly file system stuff, like access across like that and inside of a computer system.
Threads.
It goes beyond just that.
Oh yeah,
it's basically POSIX ownership across all of that, like who can do what and where. It's a
So like P threads. If you've ever heard of P threads, that's POSIX threads.
Okay,
that's what the P is. A lot of it's file system, but it's also like how to talk to the OS.
Okay.
It's a lot of how it's basically how do you talk to the OS is really what it comes down to, right?
Yeah.
So it includes file systems, threads, like PIDs, the process stuff, like all that kind of stuff. That's all POSIX.
Great. So the fact that Python is a large standard library, is that also one of the things that helps with, like you're saying, making sure it covers all these different bases? Is that maybe part of it?
Yeah, it's definitely a part of it. If you look at the OS module, right? A lot of stuff in there.
Okay.
Et cetera. Various places where we try to write cross-platform code in the standard library requires working with POSIX because that's the only consistent way to work across Linux distros, right? And usually also works with Mac. And then there's Windows.
Yeah, yeah.
And so usually it's POSIX and Windows, and that's the two you target. And usually that works across the board, which is why POSIX is so convenient to have in the world as a standard in the Unix world.
The last thing I want to kind of mention on this one, and hopefully I won't go too deep on this, but
okay,
what is your interest in this? Like, what excites you about WebAssembly? The potential of it, existing projects, the future of it. I understand the browser as this kind of universal thing that runs on a phone, a tablet, a computer, your TV, what have you. And I think we briefly touched on this before, but like, what is your excitement? Why are you invested in this?
I think I've said it on this podcast previously, but the whole reason I got into WebAssembly was to try to get Python into the browser because my wife complained about Jupyter Hub.
Yeah, okay, right.
Basically, her having a Jupyter notebook open in the browser, being connected to Jupyter Hub for a data science course she was taking, and have it disconnect after dinner and going like, what the heck's going on? I thought this was being done in the browser. Like, no, no, server over there.
Right.
And say, please go. And then her turn to me and say, you should go fix this.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Right. So that's how I got into the WebAssembly. As to WASI, and I looked at the stuff, and WASI seemed like, for me, because I'm enough of a specs person, I liked WASI because WASI is more of a specification, right? Emscripten is a cool piece of technology, but it's a full tool chain thing and all this stuff. Well, WASI is more, has specs to it. And it's just
okay.
Either approach. Emscripten has done a great job. I mean, all this has taken over the browser. The interesting thing for me now for WASI is WASI works everywhere where the browser is not the key concern.
Okay.
Right?
So it actually goes to the next step.
So IoT, right? Actually, people use WASI on IoT as a target where you run the host on the IoT device, and then you can target whatever you want on there, and you don't have to worry about it, right? Like WebAssembly, for instance, if you're a Disney Plus user or an Amazon Prime user, guess what? That app running on your TV is actually WebAssembly.
Yeah.
All the business logic has been done in WebAssembly, and then they just have to do the UI per TV or whatever to make that work. So for me, WASI kind of fills that gap of just wanting that secure sandbox somewhere.
Okay.
And I did look at Python security potentially for a PhD thesis. So I've had a long running interest in Python and security and how do we potentially run it securely. So for me, that aspect of WASI has always been interesting, and the portability of it, right? Like if you can get a host running anywhere, suddenly Python becomes portable everywhere versus our current thing of just like, as long as you have a C compiler, you can get to Python, but then you still got to have that C compiler going and running. And that's an extra hoop versus someone else solved the WASI host problem, Python's suddenly on the machine instantly.
Right. And our main target right now is WASM time.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, if they're all spec compliant, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
I use WASM time because it's part of the PyCode Alliance, which runs kind of the WASI specs. But really, any WASI compliant host can totally do it. It's just WASM time is the default because it's there. I know the developers.
And it's running on the machines that you use.
It's bigger chances on the machines because it's used more widely.
Okay.
But after that, it honestly, it's being used at work.
Okay.
You might not know this, but WASI is being used in VS Code, right? Like, for instance, the Pylance team wanted a way to look at your PTH files because you can have arbitrary code execution in there, right? And if you'll know about the Light LLM security problem that all happened like a month ago, the reason that whole security snafu happened was because the malicious actors got a PTH file in there that did some nasty stuff. So it wasn't the PTH file that was the security hole. It just automatically caused some code to run, which did the nasty stuff.
Yeah.
And people were just caught off guard because they just didn't realize that mechanism existed.
Okay.
Anyway, key point is to prevent that kind of thing from happening when Pylance wants to look at a package to tell when it was an editable install. It loads the code in the PTH files through WASI, and in WASI, it just turns off file writes, networking, and
sandboxing it out.
Anything that can exfiltrate data out, it's turned off. All it can do is read disk. And then it just runs Python code in there, just like, hey, print out what sysout path ends up being after you load all those PTH files. So that's all done in a secure sandbox. It can't do anything nefarious, and it just prints out what sysout path should be.
Okay.
And then now Pylance knows where to look for your code to give you those squiggles saying this isn't installed or hey, this type doesn't match, right?
Okay.
A lot of people doing edge compute are now using WASI because it can be extremely fast and it's a secure sandbox, right? Like Cloudflare uses V8 from Chrome.
Okay.
But Fastly uses WebAssembly and WASI directly. Azure Hyperlight is another thing that runs on top of Kubernetes that's able to do edge compute kind of stuff. And that uses WASI, right? And there are some cool tricks you can do with WASI, right? Like you can freeze memory. Like you can actually get the Python interpreter started up and basically all the way up to the point to start running code and freeze the memory.
Right.
That way, that entire startup cost goes away.
You just
And people have done that. I have
just sort of like open it up again, it's there.
Yeah, exactly. I haven't put in official support for that kind of thing yet, but there are a lot of people who do that anyway, and it makes startup instantaneous. Like, we're talking nanoseconds.
Okay.
To get Python up and running, because it's cool. Basically already running before your code starts to go, versus milliseconds. So it's an interesting piece of technology that was an interesting challenge that I had spousal motivation for originally, and now I have some work motivation.
Yeah,
the people are also just really nice, and
that's cool. You like the Bytecode Alliance people?
Yeah, they're great, and it's just an interesting challenge, and it's not too heavy of a load on me. I have what I call WASI Wednesdays at work.
Okay,
where I spend Wednesdays working on WASI, and yeah,
cool. It's time to shine a spotlight on another RealPython video course. The Zen of Python is a collection of 19 aphorisms that capture the guiding principles behind Python's design. Tim Peters wrote them in 1999 as a joke, but they became an iconic part of Python culture that was even formalized as PEP 20. And this video course is titled Tapping into the Zen of Python. The course is based on a written tutorial by previous guest and RealPython core team member, Bartosz Jaczynski, and your video instructor is Will Mead. And Will takes you through the 19 aphorisms in the poem, describing Python's design philosophy, how running import this in a Python interpreter displays the complete text of the Zen of Python, how the aphorisms are guidelines, not strict rules, and some intentionally contradict each other, and how the principles promote readability, simplicity, and explicitness, while acknowledging that practicality matters. I think it's a worthy investment of your time to learn the Zen of Python, and to understand why Pythonistas often refer to the Zen as a source of wisdom and guidance, especially when they want to settle an argument about certain design decisions in a piece of code. Real Python video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. Moving on to the next one.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one that is not approved as of the moment, and we've kind of talked about it on the show.
It's actively being worked on.
Yeah, okay. So this is PEP 832, Virtual Environment Discovery, and we've kind of touched on it even together, this concept about virtual environments. And
when you and Christopher have actually touched on it on the podcast as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Christopher has come out as supportive of this.
Yeah. And he's kind of, he's got his own way of handling virtual environments too.
Yep.
But he agrees that this makes sense. So let me just, again, this seems to work. I'll read the abstract. This PEP sets out to help make the discovery of a project's virtual environment easier for tools by providing a default location as well as a way for a project to point to its preferred virtual environment when it differs from the default location. You mentioned this just even a couple minutes ago about how other languages that have come along later have had a little easier time around things like this.
Mm-hmm.
In the virtual environments, like even like in a Node, or I would guess, I haven't tried it in Rust, there's a standardized way to do this. And we have started to become circling around this idea of using a hidden directory .venv. That's kind of becoming more standardized. I didn't know this was how it worked in UV, but I saw some sample code of like how to set something up the other day. And they're like, yeah, just type UVvenv, V-E-N-V. And I was like, oh, okay. I don't even have to give it the name. No, it defaults to naming it .venv and creating this hidden folder, which I'm like, oh, okay. That's intriguing to me that it's like sort of baked in with a lot of these tools. We have talked about
sort of
on some of them. Yeah. We've talked about how I asked you what your common practice was, that in my common practice, I'll say again, I've said it on the show a lot. I test a lot of projects out. I try out a lot of different code. I was, looking at a lot of stuff, code from, real Python things and so forth, is that I'll make a folder for a project and then I'll create a virtual environment inside of that folder kind of per project. That's been my methodology.
Under what name?
I was using just VNV before, and now I've kind of switched to using .venv. probably the last 2 years I've been doing the hidden directory. Mm-hmm. And there's good reasons for that, that it's, you know, by default ignored by Git. Typically, you know, you've got your Git ignore list and things like that by default. So that's kind of been my standard. I know a lot of people, like, especially in the data science world, kind of going back to them, if you're working on the same type of projects, it may make sense to have one overall environment that you use, that you install the tools that you like to use into. The trick then is then if you ever want to share that code as a standalone project to somebody else, mm-hmm. it's like, well, what all is in there? And so it kind of gets a little messier. And so there is still some argument there, but there's a lot of pushback from some vocal people out there. I'll include links to that. I think you even have a link inside the PEP for it in the discourse. But how's it going? I guess would be one way I could start us into this.
Well, I think the good way to talk about how it's going is to talk about what the problem space is it's trying to solve and kind of point out why it's so hairy.
Yeah.
Right? So, as you mentioned, up until like 2 years ago, you were naming your virtual environment VENV, right?
Yeah.
Which is neither right or wrong. There is actually no standard around this.
Yeah.
Technically, there's no standard around virtual environments. It's just whatever the VEMV module makes. But there's actually no PEP written anywhere that defines how a virtual environment works, what it looks like, anything.
Right.
Okay. Now, you mentioned tool support VNV as a location for the virtual environment, right? You, as you said, UV very specifically defaults to that, right? And one of the interesting things with UV is they rely on the fact that they view that they consider themselves fast enough. And I'm phrasing that just in case for some reason someone doesn't think that. But the design decision they made was, we're going to have one virtual environment at any one time. And if you need a virtual environment that targets like a different Python version or installs different things,
right,
we'll just recreate the virtual environment from scratch. So they only need the one, right? Now, when we're talking about workflow tools, they pretty much all support detecting that there's already a virtual environment in at the .vnv location in the project, right? VS Code included, right? And that's my, I will totally put that on me. I made that happen.
Right.
Because that's my preference. And I will say I did a poll once on the website formerly known as Twitter, and that won out, although it was not a majority, it was a minority. But anyway, regardless.
It was a plurality, though?
It was the winner. It just wasn't a clear winner, but I had to make a choice. So I went with top VNV. Anyway, the key point is they all support it if it's there, but that's not necessarily where they default put it, right? Hatch doesn't put it there, for instance.
Yeah.
PDM doesn't put it there by default, I don't think. Like, they all, Poetry doesn't. They all have different places, partially because projects like Hatch, for instance, is a good example, support defining a myriad of potential virtual environments. Like, you could define an entire matrix, right? Like, I'm going to support these Python versions. I want to support this for coverage using this Python version. I want testing on these different versions. I want this for that, blah, 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 right? So, like, you can configure Hatch to have, like, as many different types of, as many different virtual environments with different Python versions and things installed as you want.
Yeah.
And they don't put it all that in .vnv, right? They put it in their own location. I think it's .virtualenvs. And then they have subdirectories per virtual environment. So here's the question. How do you tell your code editor where the heck that virtual environment is?
Right.
Or even if you want to be really cutting edge here, how does your model, how does your AI model know what to use?
Right.
Right?
Have you seen standardizing happening behind the models, or is that all over the place too?
I have seen the models too many times try to do a pip install without a virtual environment activated to claim that there's any standardization among the models. The models know what they have read on the internet, and they have apparently not read enough on the internet to have made a decision.
Oh, gosh. So, okay. So it would like install into your main, you know, system, you know, it's whatever mixed. Python.
It sometimes it
doesn't know it should needs to be activated.
Sometimes it notices, sometimes it doesn't. I mean, this is one of those things where instruction files for your models really comes into handling when you say, like, hey, make sure you use a virtual environment and here's where you should put it and here's how you use it.
Right.
That can be really handy. But I have pulled people and said, like, hey, what are some of the biggest problems you run in with models? And one of the consistent ones is sometimes the models don't use virtual environments, even though it's right there. Or we'll use it if it's there, but they won't create it, right? And it's, oh, if it's not there, then I'm just going to call pip install. Or if it's activated, it's fine.
Oh, so you would have scaffolded it, and then it would have been fine.
Okay. Yeah, it's a mixed bag. It's some people seem to not run into this very often. Some people run into it constantly. It's all over the place. And then good luck to you if you don't use the standard project layout too, right? Because I worked on a project that was a model repo for multiple languages. And in the models, I had to very explicitly say, like, hey, the Python code's in the Python directory. Make sure you do this first before you try to run Python code, because otherwise they just do pip install. And like, nope, stop. Do not install into my global Python install. I don't want that.
Yeah.
Right? So point is, but these are the same mistakes beginners make, right? So I don't want to nitpick on models as the core concern for this, right? Because people, right, as you said, have opinions on this.
They just read it off the internet. I mean,
exactly. But the problem is everyone on the internet has their opinion on this one. This is one. Right. It's borderline holy war here. It's almost Emacs versus Vim, right? It's like, I want to keep my virtual environment in with my project code,
yeah,
or I want to keep it in a unified directory somewhere else.
Right.
Pros and cons for whatever reason doing any approach. But the point is the models can't read the internet for an agreement because there is no agreement. People do it bunch of different ways. Hence my suggestion is, if you're running this problem, you probably need to write down some instructions for the model for your project.
Yeah.
But this happens for VS Code too. Like, VS Code is like, where's your virtual environment? Where am I supposed to look? It's different per tool, right? And there's no standard way to have a tool tell VS Code, go look over here, right? It has to, right? So like, there's a Python environments extension that now exists that's, I don't think it's rolled out 100% to everyone yet, but it's there and available. You can opt in, and I think you can opt out still. That is there to try to help find environments and manage them, because this is such a thing, right? Because if you can't find it, once again,
yeah,
how are we supposed to type check your code? We can't find the code to type check, right? If you install whatever thing from PyPI, we need to be able to look at the code to figure out what types are to be able to tell you, hey, with Pylance and PyWrite, yeah, this is not looking right.
Right.
This says it's supposed to be an int. You're using it as a dick. Oops.
We can't give you any advice.
Right. Or with the AI models, like, hey, they want to install something, they need to know where to install it appropriately.
Yeah.
How do you tell them that? And so PEP 832 eventually is meant to solve that. Now,
yeah,
you asked how it's going. So here's the thing. Some people, like me, only ever have one virtual environment going at any one time. Right, I just use .vnv. If I needed something else, I delete it and I recreate it. Right, virtual environments are very specifically designed to be ephemeral. They're not meant to be permanent. You're not supposed to check them into version control. They're meant to be just.
They're not the code.
They're not the code. Never put your code in there. There's a reason why there's now a .git ignore file when in the virtual environment directory as of Python 3.14. Do not put your code in there.
Oh, okay.
Virtual environments are borderline. It's basically an implementation detail. Right, it's just a mechanism. And that's why it's also hidden, right? Why I support .vnv and have that dot to make it hidden. It's like, it's a thing. It's there. And it's there to isolate what you install from your global install so you don't pollute other projects. But how it works is
basically
an implementation detail, and you shouldn't care. You just should care. I need a virtual environment. It's that directory, and anything in it is a black box to you, right? But some people want one. Some people want 20. Some people want it in the local directory, some people want it somewhere else. So how do you tell VS Code or tell an AI model or whatever where to go looking for your virtual environments, right? Because we have not taken an opinion, so people have developed their own opinions versus like in Node where it's Node modules. No argument. It just, that is it. You have no choice. It is Node modules, that directory. Versus here where it's like, if I tried to tell people virtual environments should be over here, like, no, that's wrong. I disagree. It should be over here, right? This is the thing. Everyone goes like, I want a standard. Let's get all the tools to support and work. Okay, this should be, how about we make this standard? No, that's not how I work. That's not how I want it. I want it the other way. And you do that, and another person now upset, right?
Yeah.
It's one of these things where there's not enough consensus over the solution, just that there's a problem that it's really hard to solve. So as of this recording, PEP 832 says, okay, if you have no opinion and you just need a place to put a virtual environment, just put it in .vnv in the project and just be done with it, right?
Right.
That is acceptable. Everyone should understand that. If you check and find it, just use it. Like, there should be no controversy. And then I also created the concept of a .vnv redirect file, right? There would just be a file that just recorded, hey,
yeah.
It's not...
The princess is another castle.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Great analogy, right? It's not... The virtual environment's not here. It's over there. And all it was a file that just had a path in it. It was like, it's dirt simple. But... And if you look at the PEP, a lot of tool maintainers liked it. UV was lukewarm, and half of the maintainers, so Ofik Lev didn't like it, but Carrie, I think Hawkins is Carrie's last name, supported it, at least initially. But like PDM supported it, Poetry supported it, Talk supported it, slash virtual lamb, because that's pronounced same maintainer, supported it. But then when I posted it, immediately there was a but what happens if I have multiple virtual environments? And it's like, well, all this is supposed to do is tell you kind of where the default is, right? Like, if you needed something, if a tool said, I need to run some Python code, what should I just use right now? That's what that file represents.
Yeah.
Right? So, like, if your tool had a way to switch virtual environments, right? Like, then that switch command to say, like, all right, use this instead of this other thing, just change the file. Done. Right? And it's designed even for you to be able to handwrite it. Right, is designed specifically so a human being could actually write out that line in that file in your editor and save it and be done. But some people are like, no, you got to support that. And then other people were like, well, what about Conda? I was like, well, this is a PEP, not a SEP or CEP. Conda enhanced proposal. Conda does their own thing. So I wasn't trying to support that. Yeah. I was like, well, why not? Why don't we try to bring in Conda and support Conda at the same time and do Conda environments? Like, okay, that's a whole nother thing. And then Ofek from Hatch said, and I mentioned this in the PEP, he thought, like, this is too limiting, right? Like, the .vnv thing's fine. Like, that's not controversial, but this redirect file is kind of limiting. It doesn't solve enough of the problems. What we really should do is come up with a way for tools to communicate with other tools for them to just tell you what they need to know. And so I said, okay, fine. I'm going to start a separate discussion for anyone who doesn't care about this and want to get into the nitty-gritty details and just want to know the end result of a discussion. But let's talk about what that would look like. So I started a separate discussion about, like, okay, how do we make this more of a programmatic API where it's kind of push versus pull, right? Like, a tool could push to a .vnv redirect file, right? Like Hatch. And write down that file, and then VS Code would pick it up. But if the file didn't already exist, VS Code wouldn't know how to say, like, hey, I opened this new project that you just checked out, but there's no virtual environment. I don't know what to do here. What do you want? What do I do?
Right. Should we create a new one or whatever?
Versus kind of a pull thing from VS Code's perspective, like, all right, I'm going to pull from you your virtual environment. I'm going to say, give me a virtual environment to Hatch, and then Hatch says, okay, here you go, right? So kind of start the first run experience isn't create a virtual environment and then launch VS Code. It could be launch VS Code and then VS Code talking to your workflow tool will then create a virtual environment for you, right? So there's a little less chicken and egg problem. But that's a lot more work, right? How do you write that down?
Yeah.
Right? How do you...
And that complexity is probably not as attractive to lots of other people. So.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing, right? Like the initial solution, PEP 832, is extremely... clear cut, right? It's either a directory or a file, and the file is just a path to another thing. It's like a weird way of doing it, some link. Done.
Right.
But some people find that too limiting. So some people are asking for more. So the question is the more going to give you enough to warrant that? And is it flexible enough to give everyone what they need for the vast majority of use cases? Because you got to somehow make it worth the pain. While also not being so complicated that no one wants to use it.
Yeah.
Right? Because the other thing is you got to make sure people want to both implement it and then also use it at the end of the day. As it stands now, today, and I've not publicly replied to Ofik yet. I promised him I will do that today. So after we hang up, I will make a public statement about this written down. But the current proposal that seems to potentially be winning people over is actually having a protocol, like a server protocol. If you've ever heard of LSP, language server protocol that VS Code popularized and created, that a lot of other editors have now picked up, having something like that for workflows.
Yeah.
Right? Where you'd be able to say, like, hey, okay, launch Hatch in this kind of server mode and then let VS Code attach to it. And then VS Code would be able to say to Hatch, okay, what environments are available? Okay. these are it, and these ones are created or not. It's like, okay, now go create that virtual environment. Okay, cool. Or delete it or whatever. Even potentially the extent of being able to say, all right, here, go run this command for in this environment. Because if you're abstract enough, you can even make virtual environments remote, right? Like if you're doing over an SSH connection, right, on some remote machine, and you want to do it that way, like okay. If you're abstract enough, you can make that work in this case. And then have a way to kind of write down saying, like, hey, I want you, when you load up this project, I want you to use Hatch.
Yeah.
Because everything's run around Hatch. Now, as I said, I haven't publicly replied to this yet. It's definitely an interesting idea. I think I like it. People seem to like it because it probably would be easy enough to write your own custom workflow tool for this, right? Like, if Christopher wanted to go, if you wanted to go back to your VNV, right?
Yeah.
You want to do that, you theoretically could write your own tool to implement this protocol and say, like, okay, well, when there's an ask for virtual environments, there's only one. And to make it work, you just call create, and it's just gonna be dot, it's just gonna be VNV in place or even .vnv and just meet your workflow and you're done and that's it. Question is like, how hard would that be? Would it be simple enough that if I turned to you, Christopher, and said, like, hey, to use this, you could actually write your own tool, your own script.
Right.
And just have it do what you want.
That's what I feel like. It's like a script, you know, more than it is a full defining, you know, application or whatever. You're just sort of like, it's kind of like the dawn of MCP has made people sort of think about this a little bit.
Yeah.
In a way, this idea of like protocols. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Well, and it adds flexibility enough for various tools to do it, right? Because if you think about from a Hatch, from, like taking Hatch as an example, right? They have all these commands that do all this stuff anyway. It's just not in a unified way to make it discoverable that A, you should be using Hatch, and B, how do you use Hatch to make this happen?
Yeah.
Right. Because every tool, whether it's Hatch or UV or PDM or Poetry or whatever, they all have different command line arguments and all this stuff to make for the same thing, different names for things, whatever, versus if we had some standardized way to name things, it'd be way easier to do.
Yeah.
And then the other question then becomes like, well, will models pick up on this? Will they be able to work with it? Like,
yeah.
Chances are there'd probably be a CLI command, kind of like build, like on PyPI, where you can just install build and go build, blah, 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 and it will do the right thing for build. I suspect it'd be probably be a generic tool that would kind of understand the protocol, so you could actually have a unified CLI on top of it to go like, hey, workflow, server protocol thing, virtual environment create, and then here's the args you would have passed to the server running, but here's the, how to do it on the command line. Do the exact same thing, and now it's going to run and do the thing, and now you can understand it, and it's a, and models could just run it manually in the command line versus keeping a server running.
Yeah.
So I think there's definitely potential there. We have to work out some details. Assuming I can get enough people on site who are initially skeptical, which I think really is going to tie down to how much work would it be to write my own custom one for my own personal workflow,
right?
I.e. the people who like run Vim manually, who run pip manually, and just like, how do I make that work? If that's simple enough, I think that might win enough people over that PEP 832 could become that standard plus just .vnv if you just need to choose something.
Okay.
Just always check for that. And if it's there, use it. If not, probably use this tool.
Yeah. We're definitely in a watch this space kind of time here and watch the conversation. Or I guess you can join in.
Yeah, you totally can. It's all on discuss.python.org and it's actively happening. But this is just kind of a hint as to kind of like why these PEPs can be so big and take so long and it's so involved, right? Like yeah. I've come in and talked about how many years it took me to do lock files, right? It's just people have opinions. They have their workflows. They prefer them for reasons. And I'm not saying their preferences are right or wrong, but it's how do you get everyone to reach some level of consensus such that people will actually want to use it and tools will actually want to implement it, right? Because I have to convince Hatch, PDM, UV, Poetry, potentially Virtual M.
Lots of parties have to be happy.
Virtual M wrapper. It depends on what level you want to look at this as. They all need to implement it. And then everyone else has to go like, yeah, I like that. I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
VS Code. I got to get VS Code to use it. I got to potentially get PyCharm to try to use it. Right? Figure out how to make the models understand it and use it.
Right.
And just like, is everyone on site enough that this is going to be the right solution? Because if we do this, it does open up an interesting thing of, well, now there's idea of other things we could standardize this way. Like there's been talks about how do we standardize like the concept of tasks? That's always been kind of floated around, but no one's wanted to really tackle. But like, suddenly, can we standardize how to run tasks by these workflow tools? Because a lot of them have that concept, kind of like scripts in your package.json for Node, right? Like, how do we do that? Well, this might give us a way to start doing that and looking at that and kind of make it so that your workflow tool can do it however they want and implement the way they want. But at least there's a unified way for all the other tools that want to work on top of it to know how to call it to get that unified API. Well, how the API implements things is totally up to that tool.
Yeah.
So it might be a big thing. It might be a really small thing. Maybe I get burned down and I just say, forget it, and I withdraw the PEP. Who knows?
Okay. Do you have time for us to dig into type server protocol?
Yeah, well, so this is kind of interesting, right? This kind of ties into this whole thing of...
It does, right.
...server protocols and kind of going that way. So I am tangential to the Pylance team.
Yeah.
I don't work on Pylance directly, but I'm on the same general team, the Python team at Microsoft. One thing the Pylance team has been working on is, yeah, this type server protocol, TSP. And they've been working closely, specifically with Pyrefly on this. And it's a similar kind of idea of, you know what, Pyrefly implements types, right? It's a type checker.
Yeah.
It knows where everything is in your code. It knows where every class is. It knows what methods there are, what things should be, et cetera, et cetera. Pylance runs Pywrite, which is the exact same. It's also a type checker. It's the exact same thing. Now, there's going to be differences because, like, type inferencing, like, okay, this could be this or this. How are we going to decide? Is that an error? Are we going to say both are possible? Are we going to look at other uses and say it's supposed to be an int, even though it could be int or a dict? Like, there are a lot of open choices, even in the typing spec, as to how to make certain decisions. So there are reasons to want to use different type checkers for different reasons. But go to definition in your editor. Kind of a universal thing. And you kind of can do that when you have a type checker, because the type checker has to know where everything is so that when you're looking at your code, you can tell whether that type's right or not. So what type server protocol does is basically goes to type checkers and says, hey, you know what? If you have a server that can talk TSP, we can handle all the go to definition stuff. You be a type checker, you let us be an editor tool for you. Hmm. Right? And then that way, VS Code or any other editor that wants to implement this can go like, okay, you as a user could choose Pyrefly, you as a user could choose Pywrite, choose whatever type checker you want. But at least for the stuff that's extremely generic and consistent for the editor, as I said, like go to definition or find all references or whatever, we can handle that for you as the Pylance team in VS Code, right? And then PyCharm theoretically could do the exact same thing. It's like the editor's stuff, let us be the experts at, you be the experts at type checking and telling us where this information is. And then we can just make all that other stuff work magically.
Yeah.
And that's what this is. And this is ties somewhat like into this workflow stuff, right? Like VS Code doesn't necessarily want to be the tool that manages your workflow unless you just need a baseline, basic one. If you want to be a hash user, go for it. If you want to be a PVM user, go for it. We just need to know how to
choose your building tools and all that stuff on your own. Yeah.
We just need to know a way to go. Like when the user says, all right, find the virtual environment. We need a way for a hash or PDM or UV to tell us where that virtual environment is.
Right.
And right now, there's no way for that to happen. So if we go this far with the protocol or whatever PEP 32 lands on, the idea is to have a similar situation where VS Code is the one that can just pull up where your virtual environment is and tell your type checker where to look or all that stuff, or have your run button do the right thing in your editor.
Yeah.
But you can still let the tool you chose do the thing the way the tool you chose does it, because you probably chose it for a reason. Same with type checkers and all this. So
yeah.
TSP is specifically this type check. It was just announced at PyCon US, and as I said, been working with Pyrefly on it. It's out. It's in preview, but it's a similar idea, right?
Yeah. I'll include some links with some documentation. If you have anything new, you can send it to me, and I'll include it also.
But yeah, so yeah, it's a very similar idea of just kind of like, let the tools be what they're best at, and then for all of us that need a plug into or to work with it, let us know how to do that. And then that way everyone can choose the tool they think is best, but then everyone's not stuck in this scenario of like, how do I make my tool work with this other tool?
Yeah.
And going like, I don't know. Right. And like VS Code having to bake in direct support for Hatch PDM, like having to implement the same thing five different ways so that it matches the tool. And if the tool ever changes, we suddenly break and it's a mess.
Yeah.
Versus just like, no, just have your tools and that's one thing, everyone implements it, and then it works magically across the board for all editors that support this thing.
Yeah.
And so that's the start of this.
I feel like we're in the age of protocols with a lot of different things. Just like, let's define these things. Let's say what these things can do.
Yeah.
And that way, you know, our automated friends can will understand what to do and so forth. And
or any of your tooling, right?
Yeah. Defining stuff. It's just makes sense.
Me was like when I was focusing on artifacts for packaging, right? It's a similar thing here. It's like it's focusing on the API of tools so that you get to have the tool that you want, but everyone can play together nicely and lead to the exact same outcome that works as everyone expects.
Yeah.
And just making that as clean as possible. And that's what this PEP is, right? It's my start down that journey of trying to get started in working with Python as smooth as possible. So once again, my kid comes home and says, wow, Dad, that experience was great. It was so easy to get up and going working with Python and writing Python code.
Yeah.
Or even running code, running projects that are written in Python, right? Because that's another thing I really want to work on eventually is how do we make it really easy to get Python on your machine and run Python projects or code or apps that are on Python, right? Like
The inline script metadata thing helped with that some, and
and that was one of the reasons I asked for it, right? Like I was a PEP delegate on those PEPs, and the reason I pushed for it is I wanted to get that standardized so that VS Code could understand it and work with it and make it happen and actually have a meeting about it next week to get that support into VS Code, and also just to make it easier to distribute those scripts so that those learners who have that one script that launches some game engine can get their little game going with their friends.
Yeah.
But this gets us into like the pre-built portable binaries that I want to do for python.org, right? Because once we have that, then you get that one tool installed, and then that can get you whatever version of Python you need on your machine to run that script that your friend gave you or sent you or your boss, right? And then virtual environments start to be hidden even more. It's like, okay, how do we get like the equivalent of npm install -g, right? Like we don't have that equivalent in Python. Well, why not? Every workflow tool has that. Mm. But the first thing, if someone says, hey, Christopher, I want you to run this thing. I know you're not a Python developer, though. So I need you to install UV to then use UVX run thing to get this in. And some other thing might say PDM run thing or hat run thing, right? Versus, you know, here's...
The last time I did it, I did this.
Exactly, right? And every tool has its own thing versus we all rally around something that we get on python.org. At that level, at least, like just running Python code. I'm not even saying workflow, right? I'm not stepping on that toe. But if we can get something on python.org, like the Python launcher, right? Can the Python launcher be the thing to launch, to run Python code, whether it's inline script metadata, something on PyPI, whatever. And that just becomes kind of the universal tool we use to get Python code running. And then you can use whatever tool you want for development, but we all disagree on how to talk to those tools to do common things. And that way, everyone starts to still get the choices they want where they make sense, but then we get uniformity where it also makes sense and things just hopefully work together better.
Yeah. Well, I think I want to wrap up on that, but if people want to reach out to you and follow the work that you do, I don't know if any of that's changed.
Nope.
What's the best way for people to follow what you're doing in the world of Python right now?
So there's always my blog. Which I know you have in the show notes, snarky.ca. Yeah. I'm on Mastodon. I also happen to be on Blue Sky. I get a little bit more engagement on Mastodon, but I do check both, so you can reach me either.
Yeah. I see the devs kind of seem to be a little more there.
Yeah, more the Python developers, I think, have landed Mastodon.
Yeah,
I have all my notes that I keep in Obsidian are public because I use Obsidian Publish. So if you go to opensource.snarky.ca, you'll find my public notes on a lot of this stuff. It's not something I'll follow. It's mainly there to make it easier to share with people, like, hey, Brad, what are your thoughts on this? Oh, well, I have notes on this. Here's the link. Or
I don't have to rewrite it.
Exactly, right? Or like all my plans for WASI are all there. So when people go, hey, how can I help with WASI? Or what's next? Or whatever. Like, here's the link. You can see it there. I update it whenever I change it, right? So you don't have to really stare at it, but it's there if you just want to peruse for any reason.
Nice.
Well, that's primarily it. Blog, Mastodon. you can see I talk a lot on discussthepython.org. Watch the peps.
Yeah.
Eventually one will be mine because I have a problem.
That's a good problem.
Good for you.
I think for the community.
I don't know if it's good for me.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, thanks for all the work that you're doing on all this stuff, Brett. It's always great to talk to you.
And thanks for having me on as always.
I want to thank Brett Cannon for coming back on the show this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.